thousand times and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Lots of good information we're going to be sharing. The latest on how to live a longer and healthier life. We're going to talk about how to prevent fractures, whether or not the sugar we consume is actually contributing to Alzheimer's disease. New research on that is all peer-reviewed. Coconut oil. It's very effective in treating a very common condition. I'll tell you about that. And mutagenesis and mutant vegetables. They're dangerous. In fact, they're more dangerous than GMOs. Why aren't we talking about mutagenesis, mutant vegetables? We will. Also, there's a powerful bacteria-killing spice with 400% more antioxidants than blueberries. Why aren't we using it? We should. And also chia seeds, major little powerhouses. We have a lot on health and nutrition. Then we also have a lot on the environment. Three separate reports today, including 69 countries, are facing extremely tough competition for water from Sophie Yeo from RTCC. We're going to talk about millions upon millions of starfish are simply wasting away. Why? Well, everyone says, we don't know. We think we do know. We're going to tell you why they're dying. Also, President Obama, without you being told, is allowing the Great Lakes water, our Great Lakes, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Ontario, Erie, Superior, to be sold to China at a time when half the U.S. faces extreme water crisis. And also from the European Union, common insecticides are bad for bees, but they're also bad for human health. From our public health segment today, you may never want to eat shrimp again after you hear my report. And my guest in the second part of our program is Lori Wallach. Lori is the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and we will take another challenge at the super-secret Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership that you haven't heard about, and the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, and why they are so bad. New information we have just today on those. So you see, we have a lot to cover. And I'll be also bringing some new information from Glenn Greenwald into this. Plus, I end that same conversation with Lori Wallach, where we are literally becoming a fascistic country. We are also becoming a police state. And I'm not saying that. That is being said by one of the most respected veteran intelligence agents in history. 32 years as one of the directors of operations at the National Security Agency just came out and said this, quote, "The United States has already become a police state." A year ago, he said this, quote, "We are like that far away from a turnkey totalitarian state." He said that by holding his thumb and forefinger real close together. Well, now we are, he says, a police state. Now, how does that tie into these trade agreements? They do. And we'll create the mortar to seal these all together today. Now, I'm not in studio. I'm on a telephone, and I'm on the road filming. I have about a month more of filming to do to complete a long project called Poverty, Inc. And I've broken it into series because it cannot be told with just one feature documentary. I'll do one feature, but then I'm doing a whole series because just to show how senior citizens live today, where not a single news column is focusing on it, I think it deserves attention. You have 15 million senior citizens in abject poverty eating cat food. You'll see me in their homes. You'll see what they do in a day. And when the weather turns bad, the links they have to go to just to stay warm. Plus, you have to look at all the young people who are now living with their parents. and sit on those conversations. We never had that when I was growing up or you growing up. You know, you left home, you went to college, and then you went on with your life. Today, 55% of all college graduates are going back home. That's a stress upon the parents, financially and otherwise, and everyone. So anyhow, that's what I'm doing. Now, I also want to mention that we are checking at the station, WBAI, one of our sister stations, one of the many that cover this program, for those of you who couldn't hear, whether or not it was your computer, your radio, or whether it was something technically. We have a whole team of engineers working on that today, and my hope is if there was anything technically that was wrong in the sound, because it should never sound muffled, it should sound nice and clear. Over the Internet, it's always crystal clear. Over the telephone, crystal clear. But for some reason, a few people have said this, but a few, we have thousands upon thousands listening, so we would have expected more, but we're checking it. So let's begin, because we have a lot to cover, and I'm going to be sharing some new information. I don't have time today, but in the next 2 days, a brand new article, an in-depth article, very positive one. It is entitled, The Importance of Integrative Medicine in the Treatment of HIV/AIDS. It's my 23rd article I've written showing long-term survival using natural therapies, but also including some of the earlier articles, including the longest article I believe ever published in the Towns Letter for Doctors that I wrote 19 years ago and published there about the different protocols, metabolic protocols, nutrition protocols, and holistic medical protocols that can help a person who has AIDS-defining illnesses live a longer life. Anyhow, that's our latest article. That, by the way, here are some of the articles you can now read, download, use in your efforts. These are all social action issues. Right now, these have all been published in the last couple weeks. The new flu season, Pain, Profit, and Politics, talks about the fraud of the flu vaccine. The Hidden Hand, the forces behind America's economic destruction. The one I did yesterday, Bill Gates, Project Tycho, and Vaccine Voodoo. The Importance of Integrative Medicine in the Treatment of HIV/AIDS, which is up now. Fluoride, Killing Us Softly. By the way, more than 110,000 different sites have posted that. And all over the world, people are using the article because it's fully referenced and scientific valid to defluoridate their public water supplies. But Rachel Maddow is, you know, mocking fluoride. Well, then again, while I'm at it, just so you know, MSNBC hosts are quiet in a union dispute, AFL-CIO suggests. Here's what it says from Joss Edelson from Salon. It says that the AFL-CIO is wanting to know why these people over there have not spoken up about NBC's anti-union, you know, busting. They consider it hypocrisy to remain silent. None of the five, quote, high-profile progressives they've targeted, Rachel Maddow, Al Sharpton, Lawrence O'Donnell, Chris Hayes, and Ed Schultz, have so far directly or publicly addressed allegations that NBC-owned Peacock Productions exploited fear tactics and legal tricks to avert unionization. NBC and the five hosts did not immediately respond to inquiries. Quote, these hosts have a particular responsibility. FOCIO organizing director Elizabeth Bunn told Salon, quote, they have respect and they have clout that producers alone don't have, and they're part of the larger progressive movement, end quote. She said these five anchors, quote, were uniquely positioned to hear the stories of what their parent company is doing to workers, broadcast that to the larger American public. She urged them to follow the inspirational examples of workers elsewhere. Okay, just a correction. They are wrong. Those five people, Lawrence O'Donnell, Al Sharpton, Rachel Maddow, and especially Chris Hayes and Ed Schultz, these are not progressives. They do not have any defining aspects from what I have seen. That they are really good, outstanding, 10 out of 10 corporate Democrats. These are the Clinton-Obama Democrats. These are perfect people with high-paying jobs, big careers, megalomania, egos that you couldn't measure. That set beside the Empire State Building, you would see the ego before you see the top of the building. So they're doing a great job, and they shouldn't be criticized because they're the best defenders of corporate Democrat, corporate liberalism in America. So it doesn't surprise those of us who believe in true progressivism that they haven't just gone out there and marched in front of their own studio. Oh, they'd get fired, they'd stop that big paycheck, like Keith Urban and others? Yeah, I guess. So anyhow, to the point we're making, we have some important articles, including the one on fluoride, that none of these people choose to pay attention to, or vaccines that they choose to pay attention to, or GMOs. Also from an article, a question-answer sheet for understanding the deception behind GMOs, and the American Academy of Pediatrics article, Pimping for Big Pharma. So those are seven current, new, in-depth investigative reporting pieces that can help you in understanding what these issues are. Now to the latest on health and nutrition. I'm sure many of you have heard about people you know who simply, well, they broke their hip. Now the question is, did they break their hip and fall, or did they fall and break their hip? More often than not, their hip fractures because it's so brittle. One of the nutrients, according to Osteoporosis International, the peer review journal, and a project with the National Institute of Health, is that when they looked at 11,000 men in the study done at the University of Gothenburg, they didn't see these people had much vitamin B12. So now you can add vitamin B12 to keeping your bones strong. Now, with that, you should also have boron, about 5 milligrams, manganese, about 5 milligrams, silica, you could have 10 milligrams, phosphorus, about 100 milligrams, calcium, magnesium from citrate, at about 500 milligrams, vitamin D3 at 2,000 units, and vitamin K3 at about 5 milligrams. Then you've got really strong bones, and also this also help with other metabolic systems. Now, we've got a big problem with Alzheimer's, and it's only going to become exponentially worse. There will be a point in the United States in the near future where we have more people sick and disabled than we have people who are not. How in the world do you expect a minority of the people to pay for or help all those who are sick? We will not have enough hospitals, physicians, healthcare workers, and most of the care will come from home care, family care. And that also destroys the life of the people who are caring. This is the latest from Green Med Info, Dr. B.J. Hardick. Quote, it starves your brain, tangles and twists vital cells, and for decades it has been misrepresented as an untreatable, genetically determined disease. Alzheimer's is the sixth leading cause of death in North America. By the way, I believe it'll go up to number three within 10 years. I believe that we will have 20 million Americans suffering from Alzheimer's within 10 years. You won't have enough facilities, you won't have enough hospital beds, you won't have enough anything. And it'll be $1 trillion a year just to treat that one single condition. And we're doing nothing, zero, zip, not a thing to inform the people how easy it is to prevent it and what steps can be taken to change the course of the disease. In any case, now we all know that individuals affected by type 1 and type 2 diabetes have a notable resistance to insulin. Type 1 is caused by the body's inability to produce insulin. I believe most of type 1 diabetes in the United States is due to vaccines. Now, type 2 diabetes is caused by the deterioration of the body's insulin receptors, and it's associated with the consumption of too much refined carbohydrate like processed grains and sugars. But when studies began to appear in 2005 that revealed a shocking correlation between insulin and brain cell deterioration, major breaks were made around Alzheimer's prevention. Health practitioners became curious about a critical question. Could Alzheimer's disease simply be type 3 diabetes? Now, Alzheimer's disease has long been perceived as mysterious and inevitable. Over 5.5 million individuals suffer as diagnosed, and probably in at least that amount who are not officially diagnosed. But if this illness is associated with insulin resistance, wow, we already know that diabetics are twice as likely to experience dementia. The cells of your brain can become insulin resistant just like other cells of your body. People are not aware of that. Now, let me repeat that so you realize how absolutely essential this point is that you understand and share it. We never knew that our brain cells could become insensitive to insulin, but now we find out that we can have insulin resistance. So, what was once considered a mysterious accumulation of beta amyloid plaques, characteristic in Alzheimer's brain, is now associated with the same lack of insulin that negatively affects cognition. Now, where there is knowledge about underlying causes, there's the opportunity for prevention. And that's the good news. Research that surfaced around problems with insulin and brain cell death offered health practitioners a way to identify useful prevention techniques. Now, because we always like to empower people, and because for every negative and showing a problem, we show a solution that is positive, here then is the positiveness to this. Most people know that a diet high in carbohydrates indicates a relationship to serious diseases like cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. But we haven't always known that the serious effect sugar is playing on our brain. So when you eat carbohydrates, which break down into sugar in the body, your blood sugar levels skyrocket. High blood sugar levels also create inflammation, further causing your brain's health to weaken. Over time, a diet high in sugar translates into the accelerated death of supple, healthy brain cells. And studies have shown that brain cells shrink and become tangled from high blood sugar levels over time. This means that your sugar intake could be dramatically affecting your brain health, inherently increasing the likelihood of developing lesions in the brain, which are linked to the deadly process we call Alzheimer's. So what do we do? Well, it's simple. First, get all processed sugars out of your diet. Now, I'm not referring to naturally occurring sugars. Naturally occurring sugars, like when you eat a piece of fruit, there's natural sugars, but those are not concentrated. I'm talking about the kind of concentrated sugars or fructose, high corn syrup fructose, that you'll find in soft drinks and in bread mixes and much of the almost all of the refined carbohydrates that we consume. That's what I'm referring to. But then we can even go beyond that. I'm working with a whole group of people with advanced Alzheimer's and advanced dementia as we speak. And I'm going to wait a year before I present the results. But already I've been speaking with some leading anti-aging and brain scientists about the initial results, and they are formidable. I'm having everyone each day, I won't go through the whole protocol, but here are some of the things that could help you right now, or someone you know. Get them off all processed, deep-fried, and refined foods, all especially grains. Whole, unprocessed grains like steel-cut oats, that's fine, but not the instant oats. Brown rice, that's fine. White rice, no. Red quinoa, great for you. Yellow millet, great for you. Great for people who have digestive problems, easy to digest, lots of good amino acids. Then start to have the juices in the diet that can stabilize blood sugar. Cabbage juice, celery juice, and then a combination diluted aloe vera, maybe 12 ounces of good clean water, whether it's filtered water out of your tap or spring water. And then you put in your celery, cucumber, kale, watercress, Swiss chard, mustard greens, a small amount of mustard greens because it's real strong. But that is terrific for diabetics and people with Alzheimer's. Then your fatty acids are crucial, especially those that can impact your brain. And at the top of my list are two oils that just stand above all the others. Organic raw coconut oil and the black cumin seed oil, taken in equal amounts twice a day. Now, coconut oil takes action on the brain just after a small dose of the medium-chain triglycerides. Those are the primary fats found in coconut oil, and they're powerful in rapidly helping to boost brain metabolism and therefore increasing cognitive function, memory, awareness. In fact, I have some recent research that shows that patients experiencing significant neurological healing in as little as about 4 weeks using coconut oil. And coconut oil is also valuable as a fuel for the brain. And why? Because when brain cells have undergone metabolic deterioration associated with insulin resistance, they can no longer accept glucose easily, and the brain's main fuel source. However, coconut oil is rich in the medium-chain fatty acids that break down into ketones in the liver, an alternative fuel for the brain that's as efficient as glucose. So using coconut oil should make a major step towards helping to improve the overall brain functioning in people with what some are now calling type 2 diabetes or Alzheimer's and dementia. Then also maximize the fruit, the berries in particular, in the diet, plus almonds, avocado, olives. These are the things that are good for you, and you should have them on a regular basis. So that's the good news on that. And one more thing that I found about coconut oil, this is from a study in the Department of Dermatology at the Memorial Medical Center in Manila. And this was a double-blinded, placebo-controlled, randomized trial. It helped people with atopic dermatitis or inflamed skin with defects in the epidermal barrier function. So just use it internally, teaspoon to a tablespoon, depending upon your size and your need, and then just gently massage it into the skin at night. This was published in the International Journal of Dermatology. So that's the latest. I'll hold off on the others for tomorrow. Now, quickly over to the environmental segment. I keep suggesting that we have some serious problems with water, and it's going to get worse. 69 countries, according to Sophia Yeo, are already facing extremely tough competition for water. And this is from the World Resources Institute. According to the study, the first to rank countries based on water scarcity, 37% of the countries experience high water stress, meaning at least 40% of their water is taken up by industrial, agricultural, and residential use. And some of these countries are running really low on water. Bahrain, Barbados, United Arab Emirates, China, and the United States are coming in about 72%. That's really bad. And then you got the South Sudan, Rwanda, Central African Republic, Burundi, Benin. So what we have to do is we have to start paying attention not to be privatizing water. It's a common, and we should use it in common. Secondly, to start to really have a national program of conserving water. And if we got rid of all of our addiction to eating animal flesh, that would save us not only methane and hence global warming emissions, it would also save an awful lot of water. Let me give you an example. 68 gallons of water to grow one organic potato, pound potato. 3,200 gallons for one hamburger's worth of meat. So it's a whole lot of savings when we shift over to veganism and our conscious and our consumption of water. Next up, millions upon hundreds of millions of starfish are just dead. Quote, they're suffering from a wasting disease. And NBC Nightly News doesn't know why. Quote, it's happened so rapidly that some species are just missing. Well, we believe that the reason this is occurring is because of low-level radiation, and that low-level radiation from Fukushima has caused substantial shifts in the ecosystem, the marine ecosystem, which then makes all of the creatures susceptible to diseases. We're seeing whales, killer whales, porpoises, all these ending up dying or sick, where we didn't see this in any measure before. And finally, from our environmental segment today, from Michael Snyder, Obama allows the Great Lakes water to be sold to China as half the U.S. faces extreme water crisis. Quote, what in the world is Barack Obama thinking? At a time when the United States is facing the greatest water crisis it has ever known, President Obama is allowing water from the Great Lakes to be drained, bottled, and shipped to China and other countries around the globe. Right now, the Great Lakes hold approximately 24% of the total supply of fresh water in the entire world. Considering the fact that global water supplies are becoming extremely tight, this is an invaluable resource. One recent UN report projected that 2/3 of the people in the world will be dealing with water stress, and 1.8 billion people will be facing absolute water scarcity in the very near future. So why are we allowing foreign corporations such as Nestle to make billions of dollars pumping water out of the Great Lakes and selling it overseas? And then he goes into who these people are, these corporations, and how much money they give to politicians, and how many front groups they support, and then how many lobbyists they hire who used to be former legislators. And then it goes on to talk about how bad it is. Quote, water shortage is causing massive problems all over the state. From the Pine Flat Reservoir, you now see a ghost of a lake in the Fresno County foothills, a puddle in a 326-billion-gallon gorge. Holding only 16% of its capacity, pine fat is the best example of why there is high anxiety over the approaching wet season. Gone is the healthy water storage that floated California through two dry years. Major reservoirs around the state need gully-washing storms this winter. And the further east, similar things are happening. Lake Powell is fed by the once mighty Colorado River, and at this point, the flow of water into the lake has been reduced to a trickle. After 14 years of drought, Lake Powell is less than half full. Water flows into Lake Powell, nestled between Utah and Arizona, from high in the Rocky Mountains via Colorado River. More than 30 million people in seven states depend upon the mighty Colorado for water to grow crops, fuel power plants, and keep cities like Las Vegas alive. But this year, the worst drought in a century has slowed the flow to a trickle. And it goes on talking about all these different cities and how much we're draining them. And boy, it's serious. U.S. Geological Survey, quote, a volume equivalent to 2/3 of the water in Lake Erie has been permanently drained from the Ogallala Aquifer since 1940. That's the largest aquifer in the United States, and it's going running out of water. So what are we doing about it? Nothing. What will we do about it? Nothing. So here's the good news. Knowing that the politicians cannot make any radical changes to the environment, like water or soil or air, they can't because the corporations that they've received money from, the corporations they will go to work for, these individuals will just tell them, keep peddling an issue. You know, talk nicely, and it'll all go away, or people will forget about it. But you can't fool Mother Nature. It'll keep coming back. And how bad is it? It's going to get worse. So what can we do? Well, what we can do is what many of us, millions upon millions of us are doing. We're doing the right thing. We're working together. We're planning our futures in sustainable environments. We're buying land that we own the mineral rights to. We look around to make sure there's no nuclear facilities within 500 miles and no gas hydrofracking around us, that we have aquifers that are dependable, soil that's quality soil, that we're not in an earthquake fault line. We're not in Tornado Valley. And then we are going about planning a future. That's what millions of us are doing. That's the answer. I wished I could say that if we could put political pressure upon our representatives, they would do the right thing. They're incapable of doing the right thing. The entire system is corrupt. Finally, from the European Union, from Common Dreams, European Food Safety Authority says two neonicotinoids may harm the human nervous system. Now, mind you, we knew that they harm honeybees. Here's what they're now saying from Andrea Germanos. Quote, two commonly used insecticides may cause harm to the developing human nervous system. The European Food Safety Authority said that these two neonicotinoids, insecticides, quote, may affect neurological development and function, and that acceptable exposure levels to them should be lowered. We must also ask the question about the effects to the whole cocktail, the cumulative impact over time following repeat exposure to humans. Well, good for you. All right, it's, we've been saying that since Rachel Carson said it. We have all stood on her shoulders. And she said, watch the environment, the milieu. Remember back in the 1800s, there were two French scientists, Pasteur, who got all the credit, saying that it was the microbe, but Bichamp said it was the medium, the milieu. Bichamp was right, but no one remembers him. Rachel Carson was right. It's not a single poison that becomes the death knell. It is the daily consumption right now of over 270 toxins into our system. And that, over time, creates a body burden that we can't handle, and then our body goes into a tipping point. By that time, you start manifesting symptoms. By the time you show symptoms, you're at the end stage, not the beginning of a disease process. So then medicine goes to work on the symptoms to alleviate them, and rarely, if ever, gets to the bottom of the cause. So the European Union is telling us, you know what was killing the honeybees? They're adverse to humans as well. Well, so, one more reason for banning pesticides, one more reason. If you can't get the pesticides banned, at least live in an environment where you're not exposed to them. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. I'm on a telephone today. I apologize for not having the same technical quality we normally would. Now, because we have a guest on board, I don't want to take any more time. We had some testimonials and whatnot, but we're going to leave that for another day. Because I want to go over and say hello to Lori Wallach. I gave her background a little earlier. How are you today, Lori?
I am fine. I'm so sorry for the time screw-up. I had it for 1 o'clock in my schedule. I just ran to a phone.
That's all right. You're with us now, and that's what counts. Lori, you've testified to over 20 congressional committees on trade and globalization. You're also the author of Whose Trade Organization, a comprehensive guide to the World Trade Organization. You've stated that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as well as other trade agreements being negotiated in secret, really have nothing to do with trade. Instead, they're designed to establish a global pro-corporate regime that puts corporate interests much higher than personal rights, health, and safety, and the very principles of democracy would be challenged. So please begin by drawing this distinction between simple trade rules and the larger overreaching agenda that puts into place a corporate governance that makes national governments, which are supposed to serve the people, subservient to it.
That's a very good overview of what, in fact, agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, are about. So the TPP has 29 chapters. Only 5 of them actually have to do with trade per se. The things our old trade agreements used to all be about, cutting border taxes, which are called tariffs, getting rid of quotas, limits on how much stuff can be traded across borders. Instead, those other 24 chapters of TPP would set new constraints on financial regulation, food safety, energy and climate policy. Heck, it even has rules saying how we can use our local tax dollars. So all of the really inspiring farm-to-school lunch programs, the buy local programs that are rocking around the city, all of those kinds of rules where we use our tax dollars for policy outcomes would be forbidden. Plus, the agreements have chapters that set new privileges and rights for foreign corporations and for investors. This includes new patent extensions for big pharmaceutical companies to increase medicine prices. It includes rights for the pharmaceutical companies to challenge the cost-saving pricing decisions of formularies like in Medicare or Medicaid, where they decide what price and what medicines will be reimbursed. And it creates a whole system of investor-state tribunals where private companies can privately enforce this public treaty by suing our governments, skirting our domestic laws and courts, taking our governments to World Bank and UN tribunals to demand compensation for any domestic action or policy that undermines these investors' future expected profits. Under a smaller version of this in NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, over $400 million has been paid out to corporations in these tribunal attacks on environmental laws, toxic bans, water use rules, timber rules, etc. Now, a lot of folks are thinking, how the hell does that work? The binding provision in all these agreements is, quote, countries shall assure the inconformity of all their domestic laws, regulations, and administrative procedures, end quote, with the attached chapters. So you have to make all your existing and future laws meet all these policy constraints, plus give in your domestic law all these crazy corporate privileges. And if you don't, you either get dragged as the government to one of these corporate tribunals, we have to pay cash, from us taxpayers, I might add, or you face trade sanctions in another form of tribunals where the governments can sue the governments. It's enforceable corporate governance.
Let me make sure that we're clear on this. From what I understand, if there is a disagreement, and let's just say hypothetically, that a corporation, a multinational corporation, and there's almost 70,000 that would be involved just in the transatlantic one between the United States and Europe. But let's say that they want to market something in the United States, and we say that has not met our health standards or would not meet them. They could sue based upon lost profits. That would be adjudicated by three so-called referees that are lawyers working at the behest of the global units. Whatever they state would not be appealable. And if the United States loses and could not pay them, or a state could not pay them, or someone couldn't pay them, they could then go in and put a lien on or take some actual assets, which means they could theoretically end up owning our parks, our rivers, our lakes, our roadways. Is that possible?
That's possible. I mean, in one of these cases where, in fact, it's even a step worse, the tribunalists, the so-called judges, most of whom rotate between serving in one case as a judge and then later suing the government in front of their buddies, who are in that case the judges, that there are 15 individuals who either are a judge or are, and I'm using air quotes around judge, but you can't see it because it's radio, or are the lawyers suing the government for the corporation, and they just keep rotating those positions. So 15 people, 55% of all these cases. And in fact, there is an infamous case with Argentina, which has had its reversals of failed water and electricity privatizations, financial regulation measures, all attacked in these tribunals. Argentina, at a certain point, just said, basta, we're not paying. The system's illegitimate. The decisions are ridiculous. Our courts have adjudicated these things through our top court and found these policies to be constitutional. There is no outside appeal. The judges are picked by the companies. Forget it. We're not paying. And so one of its frigates, its Navy ships, was seized in a third country port by a corporation to be sold to pay the corporate bill that Argentina was ordered by this tribunal to pay.
Wow. Imagine how many assets the United States has around the world that could be confiscated. How many people are aware of how much privatization has already been put in place between private and government partnerships? This could really be devastating.
Now, here's the one thing before everyone gets incredibly depressed. This disaster, and it really is bad news, can only happen if Congress gives up its constitutional authority over trade. When the founders wrote the Constitution, they had all lived through the Boston Tea Party. So they all had a sense of what happens when you concentrate powers over trade policy, but for that matter, international commercial policy, in the executive, in the king. King George just unilaterally put up tariffs on tea and other stuff to finance his wars with Spain and France. So the founders gave exclusive constitutional authority over the substance of trade policy to Congress. The executive branch gets to negotiate, on everything, war, peace, trade. But on content for trade, Congress has the steering wheel and the emergency brake. And for 200 years of our country, that's how it went. And then in 1973, Richard Nixon cooked up this crazy delegation of all those constitutional powers called Fast Track. Under Fast Track, Congress delegates its right to pick the countries to negotiate with, set the contents of trade agreements. The president can sign the agreement before Congress approves them, and then be guaranteed to have the right to actually write implementing legislation. This is the only legislation the executive branch writes. It can't be amended by the committees. It writes changes into all the U.S. laws the White House wants to change for the trade agreement. And then that unamended piece of legislation goes to the floor for an up or down vote within 90 days in the House, in the Senate, no amendments in either place, and only 20 hours of debate. That process, again called Fast Track, has become so unpopular, it has only been in effect for 5 of the last 18 years since it was used to railroad the WTO and NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, into place. Members of Congress, left, right, and middle, started realizing these trade agreements aren't really about trade. This Fast Track is about letting the executive branch diplomatically legislate policies into place that actually we in Congress have rejected. So now, sadly, after President Obama as a candidate said, I'm replacing that Fast Track. That is an undemocratic process. I'm coming up with a better way to do trade policy that shares this cooperation between the executive and legislative branches. President Obama is now coming back for Fast Track. Used 16 times since Nixon cooked it up. 500 trade agreements since then, just the ones that are these backdoor sneak attacks with non-trade policy need Fast Track. And he's got the Democratic, just about to head off and retire, chair of the Finance Committee, a guy named Max Baucus, who's
never seen a corporate deal he doesn't like.
And then he's got the Republican chair of the Ways and Means Committee, two lovers of Fast Track who've always supported it, to agree they ought to introduce Fast Track. So that bill is going to go in 2014, but here's the good news. Already 155 Democrats and 30 Republicans have written President Obama and saying, we're never going to support Fast Track again. It's a 20th century procedure mixed in with a 21st century set of policies is not appropriate. We oppose it. Which means in the House, if we all do our work, and I mean now, the open houses for the holidays, the events, the New Year's parades, et cetera, everyone has got to see their members of the House of Representatives and get an eyeball to eyeball and then get them to write it down commitment to oppose Fast Track. That vote could happen in January. If Congress does not delegate its constitutional authority, there is enough rotten in the TPP that aggravates Democrats and Republicans alike that this version of TPP is not going through without that legislative luge run of Fast Track. So it's all about us making sure our members of the House of Representatives maintain their constitutional authority, do not agree to delegate fast-track authority. And then we're going to stop this problem.
Lori, one last comment from you based upon two issues that just arrived today. The first is from Global Research, and it says, former top national security official, quote, "We are now in a police state." Bill Biney, a 32-year veteran of the National Security Agency and widely regarded as a legend within the agency, was the senior technical director within the agency and managed thousands of national security agency employees. He just told the Washington blog, quote, that the United States has already become a police state. And then he went into why that was happening and how it happened, and it's being done without people paying attention to it. And he's very concerned about it. That's one. Then the second one is from Glenn Greenwald. Quote, this really says it all. This is today, and from Common Dreams, Glenn Greenwald, the crux of the National Security Agency spying, the elimination of individual privacy worldwide. Every story we've done is driven by this overarching theme, and that theme is that the reason I know this is what they are attempting to achieve is because they say it over and over and over again. On occasion, they say it publicly and repeatedly. They say it in their private documents, which were written when they thought nobody was able to hear what it was they were saying, and that they want to control all privacy so no person on earth has any privacy whatsoever. Now, put those two together. Then put what you're talking about. The idea that what you're talking about, when you have the most powerful financial interests in corporate America working hand in glove with the most powerful political interest, our legislators through ALEC at the state level and our federal legislators, there's an estimated 100,000 people working as contractors, lobbyists, and consultants on Washington, all for special interest group, that's called fascism. So no matter how you cut it, if you wake up one day and you say, oh, my God, what have they done to my rights to buy organic peaches, or what have they done and some other level, you're going to be on someone's watch list. And the fact that you're protesting means that now you're considered suspect, because the people in power have already put in place the idea that they have a right to know everything you're doing. And the moment you establish anything they consider a threat, they're going to be able to profile you, as they have over, are you ready for this? 400,000 Americans are now on different watch lists. We're not talking about foreigners. We're not talking about terrorists or terrorist suspects or people associated with terrorists. And once you're on there, you can't get off. And we've done shows on this. Do you see a connection with these events?
I think for next year, starting that first week Congress isn't back in session, January 7th, what we need to focus on is a bill to implement that backwards fast-track authority is going to get introduced. We need to make sure that every member of the House of Representatives votes no. In New York State, you actually had a bipartisan majority of your huge congressional delegation sign either the Democratic or the Republican letter saying no. But you've got some people like, you know, Gregory Meeks, who's actually out there as the cheerleader for the corporations trying to pass the damn fast track. I mean, it's really unclear why that guy bothers to get elected to go to Congress, because he wants to give away his powers to the Constitution and give members of Congress. You've got members who aren't quite sure what they're going to do. Some of them have voted for fast track in the past, but now with the threat of TPP, they sure as heck shouldn't. So really, everybody, it's so easy. You can either call your members of Congress locally. They're in the blue pages of the phone book, or just look online. A lot of members have office hours. If you're unclear who is your member of Congress, you can just call the Capitol switchboard and give them your zip code. That Capitol switchboard number is 202-225-3121. This is a place for all the big picture concerns and threats we face. This is a place where in the first 2 months of 2014, we the people can decide on whether or not we can save ourselves from TPP by making sure our representative votes to maintain their constitutional authority, not let TPP get railroaded through Congress on the fast track. We can do this. And in fact, the sort of historic precedent is in 1988, Bill Clinton, Democratic second-term president, who had aggravated a lot of the Democrats in Congress with his triangulation, who the Republicans did not like or trust, came to try and get fast-tracked, and 171 Democrats who did not like his trade policy. Then it was the free trade area of the Americas NAFTA expansion. Now it's the TPP NAFTA on steroids. And 71 Republicans back then who did not like the president made a majority who said no. And Clinton didn't have fast track but for two of his 8 years.
Good. Lori, we got your message. I just believe that when we have what you're talking about, which is a state of fascism where the corporate interest is the interest and has the power of law, and therefore that has enormous consequences to our freedoms, to unions, to representation, to healthy living conditions, healthy working conditions, healthy food, healthy air, healthy water, the use of our commons, all of that is impacted or could be impacted if this treaty, either of these treaties go through, and with devastating consequences. But I also believe that they have no right to be spying on us. They have no right to limit our freedom of choice and or make us seem as if we are the enemy because we're speaking up in a democracy where you're supposed to be able to. So we thank you for all the good work that you and the others are doing down at Public Citizen. And if you could give that number, the Capitol switchboard, one more time, please.
The Capitol switchboard is 202-225-3121. It's a good number to have. You just give your zip code. Tell them you want to be connected to your House member. Write down the name so you get switched over there. You can use that number to talk to them on any issue. And also, for folks who want to get a little more comfortable about how to talk about TPP or Fast Track, check out our website at www.exposethetpp.org. That's exposethetpp.org. It will give you all the information you need to talk to your members of Congress. And basically, we're going to stop Fast Track and we're going to save ourselves from the TPP if everyone does their part.
Well, this audience is known for coming up and doing their part. And call the switchboard, be polite. Then get their local offices so when they come home, you can call. Now, if you cannot meet them personally, or if they're having a meeting and you're not able to get into it, at least leave a message, again, politely, with the assistant or receptionist or whoever will take your message that you're opposed to the fast-tracking legislation, the power to give the president, and you want to make sure that you have this representative be aware that you will not vote for them in the future if they support what you consider something that is not right, and that is the fast-tracking authority by the President Obama for getting his different treaties done in secret. Thank you very much, Lori, for being with us.
Thank you. And one other good pointer is ask them to send you a snail mail letter. Make it clear you're a constituent. Give them your snail mail address and say, I want that in writing. I want your commitment he's going to vote or she's going to vote no about that. Send me a letter. That actually helps keep them accountable. Thank you so much.
Great idea, Lori. All the best to you. Lori Wallach.
All the best. Bye-bye.
I'm Gary Nall. That's the end of this program. Thank you all for listening. We look forward to sharing more on our next program.
I'm so whatever you want to do is all right with me. 'Cause you make me feel so brand new. I want to spend my life. Be all.